in the process of revising its bylaws, the rules under which the organization must operate. To read the actual proposed changes, visit pacifica.org. The National Board will vote on July 17, 2014, and the five local station delegates will vote within 60 days of that date. To be approved, each proposal must receive a majority vote of the Pacifica National Board and three of the five station delegates, aka station board members. For more information, visit pacifica.org.
Well, our computer-generated promos and materials, which include music and things that I have planned for coming up in about 90 seconds, are not working.
Yeah, that's why God invented VLC.
Exactly. Well, that's what I use, but it's getting the files to where they are supposed to be first. So, you see, that's a mistake I always make, is I consider closing that program. Right now, I can't. Half the problem, of course, is that, you know, in Firefox, which is very famous for eating memory, you've got eight tabs open. That's like, that's killing the system, you see.
Not according to...
To whom?
Program manager. Doesn't show any.
No, it doesn't. It's what they call a memory leak. Okay. And it's a very, very...
Well, we heard from the computer guys this evening that running Chrome on your phone drains your battery twice as fast as any other...
Uh-huh. They got that wrong again, as usual.
Check it out, y'all. This is Freddie Sheffield. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, New York. Listen to sponsored Free Speech Radio. Come on out every first Monday and check out Too Raw for Radio Comedy Experience. We got a reception that goes down at 6:30 p.m. and 8 p.m. is showtime. Tickets and info is available at www.wbai.org. And the place to be is the WBAI headquarters located at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. See you there.
How will I get this started? I can't even call up.
I would say once your files have copied,
you
have a better chance of getting anything to happen.
Well, let's take a look at that. Also, could you close that door so that we don't get all the leakage from the other station? According to this, they've copied, by the way. They've finished.
Okay. Well, good.
So, yeah. Okay. So there they are. No, there's the original source. Sigh.
Okay. So you should remove that now before you forget it.
Except, you know what? I'm going to use this to begin the program. And that is something, given that we're 40 seconds into the time slot, that is something that I will now do. If it lets me. We beg your pardon. Stay tuned. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program at this point over WBAI since 1972, when it was created by Margot Adler. Margot passed away this past Monday and is leaving a huge gap in my heart and that of many people. We'll hear from her and we'll talk about her. Stay tuned. Good morning. Pardon me. It's an emotional enough thing that we are going through. And on top of that, despite my having been here for a while, the technology isn't working, and people that were going to call to tell me whether they'd be on the show with me or not, whether I'm on until 3 or until 5, has not happened. But let me just go ahead with Freeform Basics, because that's a lot of what it's all always been about. WBAI wasn't always a 24-hour-a-day radio station. Once upon a time, we used to sign off the air any time after 3 a.m. Fast would go on until he didn't go on anymore. The official time was 3 a.m., and he would leave any time after that. Often 5, sometimes 5:30, sometimes 4:30. He was like that. Post was supposed to go off at 3, and it was on the outside. And it was a general basic rule that people like Charles Pitts and Marshall Efron or Paul Krasner or whoever would show up to do anything to prevent Post from signing off. And at 7 a.m., exactly, by whatever clock we deemed to be accurate, Larry Josephson began in the beginning. And it was about this time that a member of the news department, Margot Adler, made a deal. No women, we're going to hear about this later from her own voice, but no women were regularly doing live radio. And about the only live radio that we had at that time, done by women, I should say, was Liza Cowan doing Electra Rewired, which is probably, I would guess, the first lesbian radio program.
No, that was Martha Shelley. Martha Shelley was the first.
Martha Shelley was the first?
Yes, Lesbian Nation, Martha Shelley.
What year is that? I'm talking 1968 for Electra Rewired.
I think that Martha had been doing it for longer.
Maybe. My memory doesn't serve that. Baird Searles, of course, people dispute that. Baird Searles started with... I'm forgetting the name of his show. He was, of course...
Good morning, Farian.
Good morning, Manya. How are you?
The train looked like rush hour.
It always does. They don't...
Max, get near a mic if you're going to talk. That's what you tell me.
I'm going to leave.
You always tell me that I'm off.
Maybe
so how do I load that file into
Max is leaving. Maybe it's my breath.
No, it's my sleep schedule.
Yeah, he doesn't get paid after midnight.
I didn't know people.
We don't get an ops person at night.
Yes, I know.
Okay, so as I was saying, we weren't a 24-hour station. Carol Ratner, Liza Cowan.
And I remember when Nanette Renone was program director.
I'm talking
right,
19...
But that's when the high point of women's programming came.
Okay, but I'm talking about freeform live radio and the fact that we weren't a 24-hour-a-day radio station. You missed that. You were trying to recover from the subway.
No, I was jogging up the party hill to get here.
From the news department decided to make a deal with the station manager, which involved that she would go on unemployment. She was on staff at that point. She had been working for Paul Fisher, and when Paul left to go to KPFA before he became Dan Rather's writer, he hired Margot. He told me about 2 days ago that he knew exactly what he wanted. He wanted to be able to say, here's a story, and Margot would return and say, here it is. And that was being a great boss. So Margot made this deal that she would go on an unemployment, save the station money. She would take a slightly diminished role from news and go into public affairs. And she would start doing freeform radio, forcing the aforementioned Bob Fass and Steve Post to continue their programs instead of sometime after 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. and depriving LJ, Larry Josephson, he would go on at 7 a.m., but he was no longer turning on the transmitter and going through that.
It was always a thrill to do that, wasn't it?
It was a major deal, turning on the transmitter.
Mm-hmm. And turning it off.
Yes. WBAI now concludes another day of programming.
Yes,
WBAI is operated by the Pacifica Foundation.
But those were the days also. I know. We're not signing off. But those were the days when you had to test to get your license.
That's right.
And everybody, elements 1, 2, and 9.
Correct.
Which.
To get a third class,
to get a third
license
class
with
ticket,
radio
yes.
broadcast endorsement.
Mm-hmm, which meant that we could. do the readings and left everything else to people like Mike Gittle and, you know, the real geniuses.
Yeah.
The folks who could take the transmitter apart and put it back together.
Is one of the very few people who I would actually term a genius. Him and Samuel R. Delaney.
Well, Edel definitely.
Yeah.
And so anyway, you were saying.
So, well, that was actually a good pause point right there, was that Hour of the Wolf was Monday through Friday. Mondays were sort of catch-as-catch-can for Margot. She would often have co-hosts, which included Neil Conan. Don't know whatever became of him. Talk of the Town, before that.
Talk of the
All
Nation.
Things Considered. Talk of what?
Talk of the Nation.
Talk of the Nation. Sorry, Talk of the Town was Ed Sullivan.
You're dating yourself,
I knew it was. Neil, you weren't like... Anyway, and Neil was another science fiction person. He was working with Baird Searles on
Of and Unicorns baseball.
And Universes. And baseball, that's mm-hmm. correct. So, yeah, all things that I love. And then Tuesdays and Wednesdays were Margot Adler just being amazing. Just being eloquent, going on the air. Yeah, one night, she and I... talking at Olympos, which was the Greasy Spoon Diner around the corner from the station. And it was 24/7. It was open. And we would sit there, me nursing iced coffees and whatever. And Margo would be saying, Freund, I am going to tell you something that is so secret. You must not discuss this with anybody. And in one instance, it was about this amazing crush that she had on Tom Seaver of the New York Mets, which helps date this because of the New York Mets. And Freund, if you tell anybody, our friendship is over. If you ever say this, if you know, she had various friends at the time that I knew as well. This is before she knew John Glideman, who she eventually married. And it was like, and throughout this, she's telling me these wonderful things, these amazing things. And then, but with it, always, Freund, you can't say a word. She goes on the air, 5 a.m. comes around, and she had this relationship with a microphone and her relationship with her listenership. And she would then say everything she had just warned me about, mm-hmm. everything she had just told me. I was engineering. I was aghast. I was so sworn to secrecy. And here she is. Spilling it on the air.
On 50,000 watts of power. You know, the people perhaps don't understand what it takes to make really good radio and how fast you have to be, but there was something that I got today where the folks at the New York Public Library had...
from the Allen Room.
Here's a quote. It says, later, this is how fast and organized and brilliant Margot was. Later, she generously presented her current work in a public lecture. About 2 minutes before the lecture was to begin, she whirled in blue jeans. She'd been at Staten Island reporting on post-Sandy affairs. And without a note in her hand or a single illustration, wowed us all with a comparison of vampires and modern-day ecology, or rather, eco-apocalypse.
This is on the New York Public Library
that
blog.
Was right. And that shows what... a fantastic mind Margot had. She was completely organized. She was brilliant. She knew exactly what she wanted to present, how she wanted to present it. And for the kind of live radio she did, it was the only kind of brain to have. So when you think that people just get on the air and sort of blather... the way we're doing.
Well, that's all right.
And think they're interesting. Margot really was. And the way to do, for example, Steve Post, Margot Adler, that type of person who prepared the show, who knew exactly somewhere in their mind how the show was going to flow, where it was going to go. They had a sort of script in their head before they sat in front of that microphone. And that is why they sounded so good. And this is the kind of brilliance that Margot showed night after night. By the way, did you tell the people yet her first experience with Hour of the Wolf?
No.
Oh.
Not yet. I haven't gotten there.
Oh.
I was just talking about how we became a 24-hour-a-day radio station when you came in. I brought with me, as per your suggestion, I still don't know whether I'm going until 3 or until 5, but I've brought one 2-hour recording cut down to 90 minutes and one 3-hour recording.
You've been busy, Jim.
I've been busy. And it was very, 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 very difficult to do this because I was talking to you, Manya, on the phone at that time, and I'm listening. And I've been trying to deal with the reality or the air reality of Margot's death. Mm-hmm. And I will go on in a little while. Every person on this planet who she has touched, and there are many of them, have a personal relationship with Margot. And they can all say, ah, but not like mine. And I will say that as well. And Manya will say that as well. And we're both correct. Because she had a mind and a heart big enough for that. And an experience. And also somewhat different eras. While Manya and I knew her at the same time in the 70s, I was not as much in touch with her during her wife-mother period as I was during her not connected and her asexual and then her John without baby. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Alex, you're not a baby, you're 23. But, period. So, I can't begin to, should I do the before Hour of the Wolf, how I knew her? Mm-hmm. Before I met her in 1968?
No, I think you should talk about
I met Margot three times before I met her.
Mm-hmm.
One time, I can't discuss.
Mm-hmm. Because you were a little too young to remember it.
I was under 1 year old.
Yes.
And she was 8. Mm-hmm. And the fact...
She had to babysit for you, my God.
She had to babysit for me, and it involved an international incident, about which I will say no more. Although there was one story that she told on the air, which I may or may not tell at some other point. But since she told it, that one's out of the bag, and that doesn't involve me. The second time we didn't know each other but met would have been at Bucks Rock Camp when I was a camper on the boy's side and she was a junior counselor on the girl's side. So we probably saw each other across a field or something like that. But we didn't remember each other. It's just like, you were there that year? Yeah, I was. How about you? Yeah, I was. Okay. So then... In 1964, on July 4th, I was, I hate to admit this, with my accordion school at the New York World's Fair, the New York State Pavilion.
You really want to tell people about that?
I really, I'm trying to be honest and open.
This is not a time to be honest and open about that.
And I would be 9 to 10 years old at this point. And Margot would be in her about her senior year at the High School of Music and Art, where, among other things, she was a fine contralto. So
she had an upper extension.
Yeah. Yeah, she did.
One of my favorite pictures, in fact, is of her standing as a strolling minstrel with the guitar.
Yeah, I never saw that picture until 2 days ago. Oh my Lord.
That's one of my faves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goddess.
Max, do you need something?
Well.
Do you want to sit down here? Do you need me to get off the air?
I need to go home.
Did you?
Which means I need to tell you what to do.
Oh. So, you know what? I'll finish this story.
Yes.
And then we'll put on some music.
Okay. I'll close up in the meantime.
You close up shop, and Max will be back when we will take a break. So we performed at the same concert. And then in 1968, I don't recall how or when the moment that we met, but the moment that we met, we were as tight as could be. There were rumors that there were rumors about me and a number of people, including some men who were around WBAI and Margo.
And some of them were probably true.
No, none involving me. Involving me, and there's a wonderful story about that that I cannot tell on the air. But suffice it to say that I was being, I was surrounded by all these gay men, including some like Charlie Pitts, who believed very, very hopefully in younger partners.
Mm-hmm.
But these were also all honorable men.
Oh, yeah.
And I was, my sanctity, you know, I was at WBAI, yet didn't lose my virginity till well past the age of whatever, consent.
You were legal.
I was legal. Mm-hmm. I was actually legal. Who would have me? Anyway, I've never been that kind. So,
anyway...
So Margo and I, we just had this thing. Mm-hmm. It was, we did not necessarily have to speak. We knew what was going on. We shared through unspoken dialogue in a manner that has happened with me only with two other people. And in the case of one, it was not a lasting thing. Mm-hmm. And the other one is now my partner of over 20 years. But with Adler, this was since I was about 14 years old, mm-hmm. which is extremely heady.
Yes. Do you have any music?
I can. Well, you
because
see,
because there are a couple of things. First of all,
I have to do that. You talk.
Yes.
I have to sign in to get the music.
Well, I think you should do that.
Yeah.
Now I can't stay through the whole show because I have to work in the morning, but I've done a lot of thinking and quite honestly, I have to say that Margot, in her wisdom, and here's the planning, because she was so good at planning. Margot knew that there was always a possibility that she would be in a hospital and disabled, would need somebody to help. And she put together a group called a karas, which is a sort of, well, it's Greek. It was a group of very caring people, some here in the city, others farther away. But each had the ability to send energy, do rituals, be on site, visit, take care, talk to her, get her fed, all that. And when the time came that Margot suddenly felt ill and then found out that indeed the endometrial cancer had come back in new and different forms, and they were not good. She mobilized...
Now, please define endometrial cancer. I always understood it to be uterine cancer, mm-hmm. but that's not the correct word, I take it?
No, it was uterine and ovary. The surgery they did wiped that out, and the chemo and the radiation.
Which you were fairly present for, weren't you? You were...
I was there, yeah.
Yeah, you were there.
So... at any rate, when it did come back and she felt crappy and she investigated, Margot, first of all, as a very good researcher, as a super journalist, knew everything about what she was getting into, knew everything about the cancer, knew everything about all the trials that were due, sent her DNA out, got it back so that she could judge what might work. And then she decided to dump out of a drug trial that was not working. And she really deteriorated after that. A couple months ago, she was walking to work and back. Margo was a tremendous walker and a tremendous swimmer.
And all of a sudden, a mile and a half, would you say?
At least. At least a couple. So she was, she suddenly had no energy. And she started to find her way to another way of working on it. And eventually, I mean, when you beat cancer the first time, you always figure that eventually it's probably going to come back. And that's what happened, and that's what got her. When the cancer spread and became more than just troublesome. Margot's caress was with her in the hospital, and when the hospital decided, she was doing radiation at that point, decided that, well, they don't do radiation on the weekend, she came home. And she had people there all the time, at least a couple of women, doing everything, taking care, just being there, being the presence, being the caring for her. And that, I have to tell you, is nothing that can ever, ever, ever be replaced by nurses, doctors.
Any form of modern palliative care.
No, it just, it because these were people who loved her. So I saw her on Sunday afternoon, and Margot couldn't talk. Her whispering was unintelligible most of the time. And you can imagine that brilliant voice not coming out was incredibly frustrating to her. Incredibly frustrating.
Her vision was impaired.
Yes, it was. It was. But, which also bugged her, but I think without the voice,
there was,
without Margot being able to talk and explain things, that was just hell. And I know that it broke the hearts of everyone who was in contact with her. Just broke their hearts to see her not being able to talk. She had a hard time that Sunday when I saw her that afternoon. Even rolling over, sitting up, swallowing. But she had the people around her to help her. She did make it clear she was looking forward to a shower and the chance to wash her hair, which she hadn't been able to wash for 2 weeks. And since she still had it, even with the radiation, that was going to be a joy. And when Margot died the next morning, she still had her hair, as far as I know.
And Margot had, until the first round of treatment, had this amazing
long hair
that she had not had. She had only trimmed since she was 17. So,
but you want to hear something funny? When she lost her hair, she investigated wigs, and she got a couple. I saw her the day that a couple of wigs arrived. And one was black, coal black. The other was sort of a deep bronze. It was gorgeous.
Are these the ones that I have in the photos that you sent?
No.
Did you tell? No, those were
her.
Those were hair. Okay.
Yeah, that was all.
Dyed hair.
No, wait a minute. There were a couple of the earlier ones. Yes, the bronze one, that was a wig.
Okay. Yes.
But the salt and pepper ones. But she said, you know, I said, Margot, this bronze sort of looks gorgeous. Wow. I mean, that really looks great. And she said, yeah, but it's not my color. And I said, Margot, your hair hasn't been this color really for years. You know, chill. So she did. And eventually when her hair did grow out, and it was beautiful.
It was fabulous, wasn't it?
Man.
I mean, for a little while, she looked like she had crawled within her skin. Her skin, she was wrinkly and all that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then she started filling
out. She recovered. Yeah.
And, oh, my God, it was glorious. Yeah. It really was.
Yep.
If people want to know what we're talking, right now there are photographs all over social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I am collecting photos. I'm the webmaster of margotadler.com. People are invited to go to margot.adler.com. There's not a lot there now, although I've posted, I guess, about a dozen obits and audio pieces.
Oh, actually, and that wonderful tribute program, which is now the podcast. You did the link of that, which I have to tell you, the people who knew Margot, different aspects of the pagan Margot, and it is now up on the site. You immediately, as soon as I send it to you, you put up the link.
Yeah.
So that's available.
From your sending it to me to my making it live.
2.5 minutes, right?
Yeah. About. Yeah. I know who to obey, Manya.
You always have, friend.
I always have. I was a Margot bunny. I was a Manya bunny.
Margot didn't have bunnies. I was the only female in the station who had bunnies.
Yeah, that's true. Max wants to get in here.
And I think you should find some music.
I've got music ready.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So I will
put on the music.
I will put on the music. I will preface it only by saying that this is Steel I Span, one of Margot's and my beloved bands, and this is a particular favorite song of hers and mine. It's about elves. The lyrics were put together by J.R.R. Tolkien, and it is, of course, Thomas the Rhymer.
Sky moon. sacred place. We are in sacred space. We are living in a state of grace. We are loving in a sacred way.
You know that voice. I would like to mention again that you can listen to Selena Fox's wonderful show, which I heard live on internet radio, and it was made into a podcast, which you can find if you go to Margot's website, margot.adler.right. Because the people who spoke on that podcast knew Margot from so many different pagan ways. It was a joy, and they all, their voices just rang with love and with mourning also, because there's a lot of that going on. And before we go on, I just got this today. It's by the author Laura Foley. It's called Margot. It's a little poem. I am here. Listen to the thunder, the raindrops, the crackle of lightning. I am here today, and Margot is not. I dwell in the unknown. Time slowed down, stretched out in the darkness of death. And imagine for a moment the loss for her son. Once so strong, voice mellow and rich, laughter deep as a cavern, she's gone, indomitable spirit sister. I pause in the gap of her loss, the space that she's left, the hole in our lives. Margot, who will no longer throw back her head in wild abandon, no longer lead us in chants. Not Margot, with her long streaming hair. I pause in the pleasure of knowing I've loved her, her breath, the turn of her hips, her laugh that would fill the room and beyond. And now I begin to understand where she is. Surely she is above us in the rumble of thunder. Surely she's laughing now, interviewing God. Laura Foley is an author, and her new book is Joy Street. And that is what she wrote.
Wow.
About Margot.
Would you send that to me? Is that for a publication that can be put on her website?
I would think so.
Yeah.
I'll find out. I think that is just an absolutely
fabulous,
lovely, wonderful poem, and it says
as beautiful as the subject.
And interviewing God.
Oh, yes. You know, that's the punchline.
Margot had the curiosity of a herd of cats, and what she wanted to find out, she did.
Yeah. I have only one issue about interviewing God.
Mm.
Well, she's already interviewed the goddess. So
she's interviewed everybody, including J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, no. So,
which
yeah,
I'll
she
never
was the
forget.
First in America.
Because I got to meet Rowling.
You got to meet her, huh?
When she walked in, and everybody stood there looking and saying, "Oh my God, it's her!"
She was at Adler's house, and Margot called me and said, "Frank, you've got to come over." And I couldn't, so I just barely missed. And
well, I have to tell you that the Rowling that you would like to meet is the one that I met.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, she's no longer, I think, the richest woman in Britain because she keeps giving away money to good causes.
Yeah.
She just flings the money out.
She's conscientious.
I love that.
Yeah. You talk about Margot and the pagan community.
Mm-hmm. And that was one of her communities.
That's exactly where I was going.
Yeah.
That's exactly where I was going. Let us count the communities.
Oh,
that will take us until 5 a.m.
No.
The communities, she was a birder.
Mm-hmm.
She knew her birding. The New York birding community knew her.
I would,
you do this too.
I would send her pictures saying, "What is this bird?"
Yeah.
And she would tell me.
There's an app for that now. Just came out.
No,
it's called Merlin.
I had Margo. No, I don't have Margo. No, I need an app.
Yeah. It's called Merlin. It's from Cornell Lab of Ornithology. I'm wearing their T-shirt.
Okay.
She was a fine singer from Music and Archie, a fabulous contralto voice. I produced a Gilbert and Sullivan production of in the church, WBAI's church, of Ruddy Gore. My second favorite, next to Iolanthe.
Yeah, I love Iolanthe.
Those are my two favorites, Iolanthe and Ruddigore. And Margot was like the lead contralto. We actually, got people auditioned on the air. Mm-hmm. And then there was, my mind just going. So, okay, the music community, and I did not find out, by the way, until last March that Margot was heavily, this will tickle you, into the magic flute. Not necessarily opera per se, but specifically, since she was a little girl, into the magic flute, which is, by the way, one of my favorite operas.
It is one of the most sexist pieces in the world, and the Queen of the Night was right.
Yes. Okay.
And Margot knew that.
But I love the music. And, I love the Ingmar Bergman film.
You can't fault the music, but I have to take my feminism, put it in my back pocket, and sit down hard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that has to be done with much in culture.
The music is absolutely
great. It has to be done with science fiction. You and I have had fights about Heinlein, which you defended him more than I did.
No, I don't think I did.
Yeah, I think you did. Well, okay, fine. But but there are other people, women, another story, another time, but the way that certain people relate to Heinlein and Scott Card and folk like that. So, anyway.
Leapside Freund, that's my meat.
I try to make my sales at night during the night shift in office building. It works better.
I should have brought you that.
Resistance is gone.
I should have brought you the CD. Sorry.
Yeah, anyway. I would like to have that. Or you can just send me the file from it. But this is a radio drama that
we
produced with Joanna Russ. Yeah. And Margot, let's discuss the science fiction community.
Oh, my heaven, yeah.
People don't know this. People are, oh, I know Margot Adler from NPR. I know her from here and there.
Oh, she was a Nieman Fellow.
The way that I...
She won a Gracie.
The way that I ended up with Hour of the Wolf is because Margot took a 6-week break from doing the show to attend the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop in 1973, Clarion West, the what they called the Lost Clarion, because there hadn't been a Clarion West before or after. It was later made a regular thing. And when she came back, she started doing Unstuck in Time, which is how I ended up with Hour of the Wolf. Mm-hmm. I was invited to that same Clarion. I had a choice between going to Clarion and doing Hour of the Wolf. I took Hour of the Wolf, and for the moment, we're still here. So her teachers were Ursula K. Le Guin, Joanna Russ, Samuel R. Delaney, Kate Wilhelm, and Damon Knight did 2 weeks, and I think Fonda McIntyre. These are giants. Margot never wrote science fiction, but she certainly learned a huge amount during that time that helped formulate her thinking as a nonfiction writer, which is an important part of her life. In science fiction, of course, Margot turned 2 of the 5 days a week, I hadn't even gotten to that, into the Thursday morning and the Friday morning science fiction extravaganza, on which I was her co-host, where she took a story like The Big Flash by Norman Spinrad, and again, The Church. We ran ran cable so that we were outside in front of the church. And at, you know, somewhere between about 5:30 in the morning, as the sun was coming up during the hour of the wolf, and we'll get to that definition after Manya leaves, cab drivers, two cabbies pulled up and took their turn, just waited, took the book, read live on the air.
You know, you should explain that the church was WBAI's marvelous facility on the east side, which was built from scratch and was just a magical place.
It really was.
An absolutely magical place. And I remember...
I lived in the balcony, literally. I lived there for 4 years.
And I remember one of the golden moments of Margot was downstairs, and she came and she grabbed this load of mail out of her mailbox and said, well, it's time to throw out the mail, because she got so much of it. There was, you know, she just couldn't keep up with it.
Yeah, we were talking about the intimacy that she had on the air. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many marriage proposals she got from people who merely heard her?
Oh, good Lord.
And not to mention propositions, but marriage proposals.
Oh, of course. Yeah, but you see, people heard her radio persona. They did not necessarily know anything but that. So knowing Margot, the laser sharp journalist, knowing Margot the birder, knowing Margot the witch,
the baseball fan.
Oh my God, yes. I mean, there's one story in Selena's podcast of how this gentleman met her and how they started talking baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, but
She and I went to Philadelphia to see Tom Seaver pitch his first game as a non-Met.
Well, there you go.
We were
a crush.
She had a crush. I had hero worship. Yeah. But I had heroine worship. Margot was my mentor. She was my older sister. She was my heroine. She is my heroine. She is the, you know, she is my role model. And
she is the role model in many different
worlds, many different orbs.
And she was always, I think, one of the most wonderful things about Margot was she was always willing to share whatever she knew with whoever needed to know it. The first time I was in a Gardnerian circle, it was Margot's.
Gardnerian circle is a Wiccan ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just explaining.
And it was a full circle, and she and Bruce looked at each other and said, "Yeah, we'll just do it the ordinary way, and you know, don't tell the Gardnerians." But I was in a full fledged circle before I was initiated into anything. So
Bruce was her high priest. Mm-hmm. She was the high priestess who gets to choose in Gardnerian tradition their high priest. I'm doing color commentary while you're doing the play-by-play.
So there I was, this person who said, if I don't get into some tradition, I'm going to burn something down unintentionally. I need some focus and some training here. And of course, in Gardnerian, it's the male who teaches the female and the female who teaches the male.
Mm-hmm.
So Bruce took me on. I think he's one of the few who could, because he had a sense of humor that matched, you know. And that was the start of that. So Margot was Gardnerian. She was a solitary. She was a wonderful teacher. And by the way, she has updated her book, Drawing Down the Moon, consistently since it was published. So
it's gone through two major revisions.
Yeah. And if you
it's never been out of print.
No, it never has. And now it's electronic also.
As Heretic's Heart.
Mm-hmm. So you can get the updated version where she put in new information on groups and things like that and all sorts of stuff. Because that's what Margot did. She didn't just write that book, leave it, and go on to Heretic's Heart and her vampire book and other things.
Two books.
Yeah. She cared enough. She cared enough to keep things updated because that was Margot sharing information.
constantly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it did not matter that Out for Blood, which was the ebook version mm-hmm. of her vampire fixation, which we're going to be listening to in a little while mm-hmm. about her vampire fixation.
Margot would have made
she
one.
She then updated that and turned that into Vampires Are Us, mm-hmm. which came out from Weiser's in March. Weiser's is normally mostly an occult book mm-hmm. publisher, but they will just take anything with her name on it, and rightfully so.
Don't you think she would have made a great vampire? She would have been one vampire that didn't go crazy. Because she was always curious.
Well, she fantasized about that.
Mm-hmm. And I saw all the books that she read in order to research.
About 280.
I saw them on the shelves in her apartment.
Yes. And some of them are just so crappy.
Again, the research, the knowledge, and she had
the joy of her obsession.
And she had everything in her head. Everything in her head. It was all there.
Yeah, and when I had her hosting the reading series, I do the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, and we did a vampire evening, and I wanted her to hold court. I wanted, she was the host, and I wanted her to do her, turned into the vampire sermon. Mm-hmm. And she came, and I'm starting to do gesticulations uh-huh. that are uh-huh. typical of
uh-huh.
her.
Margot, yes.
And she was talking about there are vampires that... You think it's about sex. You think it's about this. It's not. It's about power. It's about having power over another person. And that can very often express itself in sexuality, like in the books by Laurel Hamilton. Like in this, like in that. Am I channeling a little? Am I getting?
And that is because Margot had every word she'd ever read in her head.
Yeah.
Organized.
Yeah.
Organized.
And more than she ever read, because so much was original. Mm-hmm. Original thought. Her summation about our, not mine, but the world's obsession with vampires is not something that she read. It's something that she gleaned. Mm-hmm. There's a good word.
Organized and came up with an original thought, which is Margot.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's the researcher, the journalist, the excellent writer, most excellent writer. And
I always regretted that she did not. Now, she had been very active in science fiction fandom. Mm-hmm. She was a member of this FSSCU, the Fantasy and Science Fiction Society of Columbia University, before I knew her. And that goes, you know, back. Since I knew her since 1968. And she was very... We went to certain conventions, many conventions together, at least 20, mm-hmm. up and down the East Coast, and one to Minneapolis. And... but there came a time when she was too busy being a writer, a mother, a journalist, a partner mm-hmm. to John Glideman, et cetera, and all that fandom, the active fandom, had to take a back seat. But I was very, very pleased that I was able to draw her back. She was at mm-hmm. Lunacon this year. Mm-hmm. And when I told the woman who was conducting the programming at Lunacon that I could bring Margot Adler, bing, she was on five panels, including, mm-hmm. you know, this whole thing on her own and talking mm-hmm. about the goddess. And I'm so pleased that in the last few years I got there. But driving back from Lunacon in March, mm-hmm. Lunacon's only 45 minutes away from Rye to her house, mm-hmm. I asked her, why is it, after Clarion, that you never wrote science fiction and fantasy? Because, I mean, imagine with her knowledge of the goddess and mm-hmm. all the eclectic knowledge that she has, she could have been one of the great science fiction writers of all time. And she said, well, Freund, it's just that I've spent so much of my time in search of the truth that I don't know if I'm capable of expressing stuff in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I disagree because I think that
I would take her at her word on that.
I would take her at her word on that because
Margot knew exactly how she could do something, and if it wasn't going to be up to her own standard, if she wouldn't read it and enjoy it.
Well, there's that.
You know,
there's
because of her perfectionism. But, you know, Margot, a friend of mine was in Germany, Rick Carr. I haven't seen him in an age, but we were talking one day.
He's got to be an opera person, right?
No.
Oh, no? Okay.
No. He's a broadcaster.
Okay.
And a marvelous guy. Fantastic, technically, and just amazing. Anyway, and he said he was in Germany and talking with some people, and he mentioned Margot. And one woman said, Margot Adler! You know Margot Adler! I mean...
With the T.
Margot... Yeah, well, in German.
Yeah.
Margot is an international character.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of her groups knows her in that group. But it's almost as if she was the center of a daisy.
Mm.
And all those interests and all those groups...
That's a lovely...
...centered on her.
That's a lovely...
And now the center is gone.
Well, the center is unattainable to us. It's, for me, it will never be gone. I spent years not as close to Margot as I had been, and that was already a gap. And I have a very simple way of dealing with death. Anger. Huge anger at being deserted. This comes from my uncle dying when I was 11.
That is one of the stages of grief.
Well, but I haven't gotten past that
stage
with any of my parents, my closest mm-hmm. people. I will cry yell.
You got to get off the dime there, friend.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying this is healthy.
No. But, you know, I once saw an artwork, and the people who had it, it had been given to them, and they didn't know what it was, and I looked at it. It was glass. And I realized that what it was, what it depicted, was the hole in the sky left by the Twin Towers.
Mm, yes.
Which they hadn't picked up on.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very big hole in all those daisy petals. Every single one of them.
Yeah.
Because Margot, although she hasn't left completely, Margot is not physically here.
Yeah. I will show you, Manya. This is not good for radio. Mm-hmm. I will show you a photograph that I have not yet posted,
Ooh.
That few people have ever seen.
Ooh. Oh.
That is Margot the day she married me.
Yep.
As I warned you.
20 years ago?
On the air. More. 1979.
Oh, a bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The marriage lasted about 3 months,
which
Adler told me right after the ceremony. She said, I hope this one sticks. One she did after that stuck very well. But this
you were just too impulsive.
Fasting,
you were just too impulsive.
Wasn't me.
Because I do know some weddings that turned into real marriages.
You were slightly, you wouldn't know this, responsible for the breakup of my marriage. Because my wonderful wife, who had lived a very closeted life, learned from you and Judy Pasternak and Viv Sutherland and a few other people. My wife left me for my best friend. My best friend was named Carol.
Sorry, Jim.
Well, you know
Truth
what?
Truth will out.
The pain was incredible, and it turned out to be great for the woman I married. I won't name her on the air. And for me. you know, it was such a growing experience getting through that. Yeah. And she was liberated, and I learned so much. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so you played your part. You played your part. You educated this woman. And she had been so sheltered.
I didn't know.
Yeah, well, no, of course you
But
didn't
if it hadn't been the group at BAI, it would have been somebody else.
Hopefully.
And maybe longer than 3 months, which would have made it harder.
Yeah, so, well, we actually lived together in Margot's apartment for about a year. Margot had this has this amazing large
place. But the wedding would have, you know, I mean, 3 months after the hand fasting, it might have.
Yeah, so we were together for 3 years until the hand fasting. Then there was the hand fasting. Mm-hmm. And when it was codified, solidified, after that, you know, I think it made a box. Mm-hmm. But this is another conversation. Yes. Suffice it to say, the way that Margot handled that ceremony was absolutely wonderful.
Oh, I have seen her do some of my, one couple, some of my best friends on the face of the earth and anywhere else. She married them because she could legally. She married them, and they are still blissfully happy together. Mm-hmm. But the ceremony she did was gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, was it the one with me? It was with tapers, everybody holding a taper. And everybody would make a wish for the couple.
No, this was, they planned their own thing.
Well, this was planned by the couple, myself, my wife-to-be, and Margot. Mm-hmm. And the way she did it, just to give people an idea, was everybody in the room, in her living room, which is a large living room, made a wish, blew out the taper, and she got to do the last taper, which was on the altar by the Athami. And when the last taper was blown out, we were legally married. And my wife had parents from the guardians, really, from the Midwest. Very Baptist, very... knowing I was Jewish,
Friends had...
They checked me for horns.
Oh, geez.
This is how they were.
Well, my friends had very conservative parents, but I have to tell you, when he got up on the stage and started playing along with the band in his leather pants and vest, and they were married in a circle of flowers, that Margot had that ability to do something that is very serious and make it a beautiful theatrical presentation.
That's exactly right.
And that's why people remember certain things about
her. But I didn't get to the punchline.
Uh-oh.
The punchline was, these people went through the ceremony. These Baptists, they thought New York was weird. You know, they thought, you know, being in New York, seeing Jews and stuff like that was weird enough. But here they are, and they thought the ceremony was strange, no stranger than the other stuff they had seen. And then at the reception, right after that, somebody walked up and say, "So, what did you think of the coven?" I was like, "What?"
What did they think she was going to do with that knife? Cut bread?
Yeah. Well, they wouldn't know. Well, and she, yeah, I mean, you make signs in the air. You know? Oh, okay. They did, and it was only word.
They really weren't prepared.
They were not, and they were supposed to stay in New York another 2 days. They left that night.
Oh, well, they ran off screaming.
But the point is that they could get through a circle. They could, conducted by Margot, they could get through a Wiccan ceremony, these very close-minded people, and had a good time until they were told with their preconceived notions what it was. And that's something Margot could pull off.
Yeah, she could. You know, there really wasn't much that she couldn't pull off in any of her spheres of influence. And that was another magical...
She didn't want to. That's exactly right.
It's like somebody that I heard interviewing a famous actress, and he said, "Have you ever thought of directing?" And she said, "Oh no, I prefer to work with my directors." And he said, his last comment was, "I think you should give it a try." No, you don't tell her what she needs to do.
Yeah.
And nobody could tell Margot what she needed to do because she
I know my thirst.
There are so many other authors.
So let's discuss vampires to segue into the sermon.
Mm-hmm. Margot, who would have been a wonderful vampire. Vampires.
If you accept vampires, this is terrible, but she'd appreciate it. It's not too late.
You know, some people used to wonder if I was one.
What?
Overnights.
Because you were overnights always, and you wear black.
Right. So, you know, people thought about that. But, you know, no.
I will.
Not
I,
a vampire. No.
We would be in the church, the desecrated church on 62nd Street doing Hour of the Wolf. And we would come out. When we went in, it was dark. Mm-hmm. When we came out, the sun was in the sky and we had to blind our eyes going, No!
Well, at least you didn't end up, you know, little piles of ash.
Or twinkling. Mm. That would be the worst.
Oh, my.
I'd take the ash over the twinkles.
So vampires.
Yes, and vampires. I'm all queued up, by the way.
Vampires. Margot and her interest in vampires. Probably now opened new doors to people who read her book. Because they would look and they'd say, oh, I know that name. She was on NPR. So let's see what she has to say.
And NPR.org, by the way, she was blogging all of the 270 plus books that she was reading in a row. Mm-hmm. And she came here. That's not the one I'm going to play, but she and I did a three-hour show in this very time slot. Mm-hmm. It was just at the time that she was writing Out for Blood.
Well, I have to say that, first of all, this time slot, Robert Knight's...
Another great loss. BAI has suffered in Eddie Ellis in the last couple of months, the last few months.
The last year.
Well, yeah.
Has been devastating.
It really.
I mean, when I met Robert's family, his life partner and his brother, who I tell you had the same twinkle in his eye.
Oh, yeah.
I just, first of all, could not believe the amount of grief that they must have been going through. And here we are, you know, in what would have been his time on the air. And, you know, thank you, Robert, for being Robert and being such an
still is Wednesday nights, midnight, is Earth Watch. Okay. I mean, right now it's sharing with Hour of the Wolf, but Robert and I have done that before.
Yeah. And Margot. Oh, Margot.
It's hard not to chuckle. It's hard not to laugh because through the grief, there's so much love.
Yeah. And if you don't. Margot, with her joy and her passion, would want to be, I think, remembered in those moments of joy and passion. Mm hmm. Not when, you know, her legs hurt from walking around covering the Hurricane Sandy stuff. And she was a walker, but, I mean, she was all over the place. And, you know, not when she was going through chemo and going through radiation. She would want to be remembered as Margot, the joy bringer.
Indeed.
Now, vampires, Freund.
Yeah. Now, she explains how she got into it.
Let's hear it. This is, by the way, WBAI in New York.
And you are?
Oh, I'm Manya.
And with me is Manya. I am Jim Freund. Manya is going to have to toddle, which is why I've actually been putting off.
I'm going to have to get on my broom and fly because I have to work early in the morning.
And you said, anyway. but I thank you. I thank you for sharing this time. This is not...
This is a privilege, Jim. This is a privilege.
For both.
And I know you're going to do another show where you have tape of people talking about Margot, and it'll be highly produced.
I have a monument in my head.
Right. And I love the idea that you're going to do that. But I'm...
Me?
That you're going to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm going to oversee it. You're going to participate. You're going to help collect sound. You're going to help come up with ideas. You helped come up with ideas for this morning, for which I'm grateful.
Okay. I will assist as much as I can.
As will other people whose names begin with M-A, you know, and Margo.
Lots of people.
But you know who I'm talking about. Some Australian.
Yeah. But
if she's willing.
And I look forward to that, you know, highly produced, really shiny program.
Yeah, and I think there's also going to be more live radio.
I think this is a very good start. Covering the Margot legacy, because she has left one huge legacy in all those daisy petals.
It's a good way to put it. I like that. And I think that will be a graphic that should be created. I'll talk to some artists about that.
Gerber Daisy, because that was Margot.
Even if we go to five, probably going to go to three, but even if we go to five, we cannot encapsulate.
No, of course not.
All this stuff. We cannot do the definitive.
Never.
Ever. It cannot be done.
She had 68 years of being Margot. And being Margot was more than about any three or five other people. That was Margot.
Easily.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Manya. And now, why... We love vampires.
And here is Margot.
Vampires. I was never interested in vampires. If you asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, "Are you kidding?" I'd read maybe one vampire novel, not the 250 I have read now. I had seen one movie, The Hunger, probably because I knew the author. But going to a conference, I bought some trash novels for the plane. I read the two Twilight novels, and it might have ended right there. But 8 days later, my husband was diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer. I started obsessing on vampire novels, sitting by his bedside while he slept, because I was thinking about mortality. My husband and partner of 33 years was dying, and he was someone who wanted to live forever. There was a definite tension between our views on death, a tension I didn't really understand until after he died. It's also a tension I realize now that exists in many of the most interesting vampire novels. My husband had what I would call the high-tech view of death. It was to be avoided at all costs. He was a runner. He was in perfect health. He took various supplements and antioxidants. He drank a glass of wine for resveratrol. He never smoked. He was fit. And unlike me, he never did any drugs in his youth. He thought he would live to be 100 or preferably even older. And a science journalist, he followed scientific discoveries and all the advances of aging research. And when he did die, he thought, he might have his ashes flown up in space. His attitude was definitely rage, rage, rage against the dying of the light. I, at that same moment, had more of an earth-centered pagan perspective. We're all part of the life cycle. Like a seed, we are born, we sprout, we grow, we mature, we decay, we make room for future generations who, like seedlings, are reborn through us. As for the persistence of consciousness, deep down I thought, how can we know? Perhaps we simply return to the elements. We become earth and air and fire and water. That seemed okay to me. In fact, I remember reading in a book by the feminist author Barbara Walker that the ancient meaning of the four elements was the way we went to die. We were left for carrion in the air, we were buried in the earth, we were burned on the pyre, and we were buried in the depths of the sea. That also seemed all right. Although deep down, there was a part of me that was on my husband's wavelength and wanted to live forever. The vampire of myth and literature embodies some of that same tension my husband and I had regarding death. They have near immortality and yet are tragically frozen in time. They cannot grow and change like the seasons or, in most descriptions, birth new life. And yet they have superpowers and strength and often the wisdom that can come with extreme age, an often cynical, jaundiced view of life. Rosalie, who bemoans her frozen state in the Twilight novels, is asking the same question asked in books like Tuck Everlasting or Olaf Stapleton's famous science fiction novel from 1930, Last and First Men. Humans want to be part of nature, yet we still want to push the edge of the envelope, seeking to be more. Vampires let us play with death and the issue of mortality. They let us ponder what it would mean to be truly long-lived. They allow us to ask questions we usually bury except in science fiction. What does one value more and what does one value less with a short human life? Is the vampire's frozen life sterile? Does life only mean something when it's part of a cycle of birth, growth, decay, death, and the birth of new life? Is there a beauty that comes only from the cycles of the season which we are a part? So in the beginning, I pondered mortality, but I knew it didn't explain the millions of readers and movie viewers and television watchers who were devouring vampire stories. An article in The Hollywood Reporter a year or so ago said, vampires brought in $7 billion to the Hollywood economy in the last 2 years, the GDP of a small nation. 117 million Twilight books have been sold the last time I looked. And this is not just a teen phenomena. There are at least 30,000 adult women on a Twilight Moms website. New vampire novels continue to be constant bestsellers for adults and teens. And on television, there's The Vampire Diaries, True Blood, and both the American and British versions of Being Human. On a recent trip to Europe, I found that my Dutch teenage relatives in Amsterdam and the 20-year-olds at a conference I spoke to at Edinburgh were absolutely obsessed with The Vampire Diaries. I wanted to understand why vampires have such pull, such popularity, such traction in our culture, both American and much European culture at this very moment in time. It's very easy to dismiss all this pop culture snidely and to say, for example, oh, it's all about teens and sex or even repressed sex. You've read the articles, how Twilight is all about abstinence from a Mormon point of view and Edward's a stalker. I don't believe it for a minute. We all now know that rape is not about sex. It's about power. I began to wonder if maybe the interest in vampires was really a meditation on power and its abuses. One of the reasons that vampires are interesting is that they, like we, are in conflict over issues of power. We want it, we distrust it, we get twisted by it, we abuse it, we love it, we hate it, we struggle with it. Almost every recent vampire novel, film, and television show confronts this issue. Amy Smith, a Quaker who teaches courses on the literature of war and also on vampire films and fiction at the University of the Pacific, puts it this way. The central question in so many of these films and novels is, if you had power over others, how would you use it? The tension is always between, we're at the top of the food chain, we can do what we want, humans are cattle, they're prey, versus, we were once human, how can we treat humans like cattle? This is the same tension, she says, that we have in life. If you earn more money than someone, if you have more power than someone, how will you use it? Does having more power or status give you the right to use it? Does might make right? It's really the same question, she says. Teens, who naturally feel invisible and powerless, since they are still under the thumb of the twin authorities of school and parents, find the fantasy of difference, of special powers and abilities, intoxicating. Whether these powerful creatures are the X-Men, the beings of Pandora, or vampires, they identify with the struggle of wanting power, yet they often see its dangers with clearer eyes than their parents, because they are watching from the outside as the older generation abuses power, often wielding it over them, often seeing their rites of passage as criminal. In an extraordinary email I received from Anne Rice, the author who has sold millions of vampire novels, she said, "The vampire, the symbol of the outsider in all of us, is romanticized by teens because they so desperately need to find a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them." Hear that again. They so desperately need to find a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. Reading that, I thought of the horrors of consumer culture they must navigate. I thought about high school. Think of the Cullens in Twilight doing high school over and over. Think about doing the senior prom 5 times. Now that's a horror story. And if we look at Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, it's all about power. Women, power, and leadership. In the last season of Buffy, she's forced to renounce patriarchal power and give up her own power for the power of all women. There are hundreds of scholarly articles just about this. And of course, if we look further back, Voltaire, Engels, Marx, the people of Occupy Wall Street, all use the word vampire to describe issues of power, usually using the word for the powerful, the corrupt, the capitalist, the Wall Street trader. Most of the teen vampire stories are not only about power, they're really about choice and identity. Bella, at the end of the third Twilight movie, describes herself as an outsider who feels more at home in an inhuman world than a human one. "This is not about you," she says to Edward. "This is about me and my choices." But that still doesn't explain what's really going on now. Every age gets the vampire it needs, feminist author Nina Auerbach wrote in her book, Our Vampires Ourselves. Every age uses vampires to express their fears and concerns, writes Eric Newsom in his book, The Dead Travel Fast. In 1897, when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, England had the largest ports in the world. There was fear of incoming disease, of foreigners, of immigration, and Stoker created the perfect monster, Eastern European, bringing dirt from a foreign land. You can do this for every period that has had a wave of interest in vampires. In the 1980s, with AIDS, for example, vampires were often described as parasites. You became infected by vampirism like a disease. And the first vampire novel, story rather, in the English language, was started in 1816 in the same chalet on the same weekend that Mary Shelley started to write Frankenstein. The fear at that time was science replacing God. So what's happening now? Who are the vampires we have created? And what are the fears and concerns they are expressing? Look at our modern vampires, most of those of the last 15 years. The Cullens in Twilight, Bill Compton and Eric Northman in True Blood, Mick St. John in that wonderful CBS one-season series Moonlight, Mitchell, the vampire in the BBC series Being Human, Henry Fitzroy in Blood Ties by Tanya Huff, Stefan and Damon in the television show The Vampire Diaries, and let's not forget Angel and Spike in Buffy. They all have something in common that makes them different than most vampires that went before. When I put their names in a line on a piece of paper, it was like a light bulb suddenly went off. Unlike the vampires that went before, they're all struggling desperately to be moral, despite being predators. Often failing, sometimes succeeding, but all engaged in a profound struggle to lead a moral life despite their need for blood. There's a wonderful scene in the presidential vampire thriller Blood Oath by Christopher Farnsworth, which came out a couple years ago. The idea is that President Andrew Johnson found a vampire on a ship and imprisoned him. He managed to get Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans, to bind him by a blood oath to serve every president of the United States. Nathaniel Cade, the vampire, is now in the modern world serving a president somewhat like Obama. In one scene, he stands in the back of an AA meeting. He does this pretty regularly because he sees himself as an addict. And while he only drinks animal blood, he still lusts for the blood of humans. We humans are addicts, not only in the obvious ways, abusing alcohol and cigarettes and drugs and food. We are clearly in a struggle with an addictive lifestyle. 8 U.S. presidents in a row have claimed they would bring about the end of our dependence on foreign oil, and they've meant it, just like a smoker means it when he insists he will quit. But our jobs, the economy, the way we live and commute, the way our infrastructure is set up, all compromise us. We depend, at least for now, on continuing an addictive relationship to fossil fuels. Oil is our blood, and our addiction compromises the earth. Vampires are exactly us right now, as we wage wars, use oil, and suck the lifeblood out of the planet. Whitley Strieber, author of The Hunger, goes even further. He says, our prey is the planet. If so, vampires are us, and the issue before us is how we can learn to use our formidable powers without destroying the world and future generations. Like vampires, we are in a struggle with our own predation. You may ask, when did we create this vampire that represents this moral struggle? At first I thought it was Buffy, and then I thought it went back to Anne Rice. But it really goes back 45 years to Dark Shadows and the vampire Barnabas. Dark Shadows started in 1966, but Barnabas didn't appear until well into 67, and the word vampire was never used until 68, and so I started thinking about those years. In 1966, Stuart Brand, the man who founded the Whole Earth Catalog, one of the most significant environmental journals, took an LSD trip on the rooftop of a San Francisco building. He was meditating on something Buckminster Fuller had once said, that the root of man's misbehavior was the notion that our Earth was flat and infinite. On LSD, he suddenly felt and saw the curve of the Earth. When he came down, he printed up a political button and sent a couple hundred all over the world, to NASA, to Soviet and U.S. diplomats, to members of the United Nations and members of Congress. The button had this sentence: why have we not yet seen a picture of the whole Earth? While there were a couple of fuzzy views from satellites, it would take Apollo 8 in 1968 to give us that color picture of the Earth rising. And 4 years later, another Apollo gave us the picture of the blue marble Earth, which may well be the most reproduced photograph in history. Those photographs changed us. At first we saw just no boundaries, and we are all brothers and sisters. But eventually, we understood the darker vision. We saw our vulnerabilities for the first time. We saw ourselves as compromised morally, standing on this fragile planet and not doing what we need to do to save her. 1970 was the first Earth Day, the real beginning of the environmental movement, as we suddenly saw the Earth's fragility, a tiny ball of brilliant color in a dark universe, a ball so small the astronauts could blot it out with their thumb. They all noted it, and we all changed. Our vampires changed at the same moment. This image changed us and our thinking. I think the vampires so many are identifying with allow us to look at ourselves more clearly, to see the compromises we make daily, the moral struggles we often lose or more commonly deny. Sylvia Plath wrote, "I'm terrified of this dark thing that lives in me." And Stephen Moore in The Vampire in Verse writes, "The reason you can't see a vampire in the vampire is a mirror, reflecting our secret self." Hopefully, these morally conflicted vampires will allow us not only to see our abuses of power more clearly, but give us a few insights on how we can struggle to live more morally on this earth. And now, when someone says to me, "How could you waste 3 years reading vampire novels?" I paraphrase something that the late great science fiction writer Philip K. Dick once said, that when the divine is exiled from much of our culture, sometimes you have to look for it in the trash. Blessed be.
Blessed be. The Vampire Sermon, delivered by Margot Adler. She did some variants on that, and if that captured you in any way, shape, or form, you can check out her ebook called Out for Blood, published by and available on Amazon.com, and her print book that came out in March from Wiser Press, I believe Samuel Wiser's. That is entitled Vampires Are Us, and you heard her invoke that quote during the sermon. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. We are a wounded station. We are wounded in financially. We need your calls and pledges, by the way, at 212-209-2950. I encourage you to become a WBAI buddy for $10. And you can call that number, 212-209-2950, and they will tell you more about it. But we are wounded in other ways, and we are taking these 3 hours, possibly a little longer, out tonight to discuss some of those wounds and celebrate the life of yet another person who has been taken from us. In the last week alone, we lost Brother Eddie Ellis, who was on Sunday afternoons. But Margot Adler died on Monday. And for me, this is a particularly grievous and egregious blow. If you look at so many of the obituaries that have been published yesterday alone, the New York Times, the Daily News, let me look at some of the ones posted on her website. I did the posting. WBAI did a piece co-written by Manya, who just left here, and Linda Perry. Current.org did a piece of Voodoo, which is the about Margot and science fiction from this is an article that was written by Matt Staggs and is in Random House. The Jewish Daily Forward by WBAI alumni John Kalish on the Jewish angle and Margot and paganism. Margot's family, her grandfather, Alfred Adler, the famous Adler, so many people. We talk again about Amanya was using the pedals, go through the psychiatric circles. Alfred Adler, as in Freud, Adler, and Jung. That Adler, that's her grandfather. I would rearrange the mailboxes at WBAI when we had enough room for mailboxes. There was a fellow by the name of Bill Young, Y-O-U-N-G, who worked at BAI. I rearranged the mailboxes, so we had Freund, Adler, and Young. But Margot was legitimate. One time, in fact, she was covering some psychiatric event or other. She was interviewing, as a matter of fact, oh, why am I blanking on his name? The famed psychiatrist wrote The Use and Meaning of Fairy Tales, Bruno Bettelheim. And at one point she was following something where Freud's granddaughter was on stage at this event, and this woman got up and asked a question. And she said, yes, hi. Coincidentally, I am the granddaughter of Carl Jung. And Margot shrieked. She'd stopped the entire proceedings. And after, you know, the bit of the commotion settled down, it was realized that here were these three women, the granddaughters of Freud, Adler, and Jung, were together. And, I mean, things that happened around Margot were truly magical in so many ways. Deadline Hollywood did a piece. CU News, Margot annually attended the conference on world affairs at Boulder, Colorado. Pathos, which is a website about faith and has a pagan channel, at least three people there have remembrances and words. Some of them are really nice. WNPR News had a good piece. SheKnows.com, Star News Online, Thalassa Musings. That's obviously the name of a blog. Pagans Tonight Radio, which is a long tribute. It is internet radio. And unfortunately, as so much internet radio, not fabulous audio quality, but well worth listening to. David Hinckley did a piece in the New York Daily News and the New York Times. And these were just the ones that I found offhand. There will be more. The impact that Adler had on so many people in so